On TV and in the movies, cops often have to shoot people in the line of duty. But for real cops, shooting a suspect is a rare and sometimes traumatic experience. My guest Roger Mangum is a police officer in San Antonio, Texas. In 1982, while on patrol, he shot and killed a man in self-defense. A subsequent grand jury investigation found his use of deadly force was justified, but it was still hard for Mangum to accept that he'd taken someone's life. A couple of years ago, Mangum co-founded a support group for other officers dealing with the emotional after-effects of critical incidents. The group is called POST, an acronym for Police Officer Support Team. Since 1992, Mangum has been an instructor at the San Antonio Police Academy, where he runs tactical training classes. I asked him how often cops draw their guns.
Well, actually, very rarely, but there's two different characteristics of pulling the gun. Police officers can pull their gun quite often, but it may not necessarily be in a deadly force issue, and I'll give you an example. Maybe they got a call for a burglary in progress or a burglary alarm at a house or a building. Because there is the possibility of forced entry or burglary being committed, that officer may pull his gun to clear that building. Or if he's going to respond to a robbery alarm and he's not sure if the robber has departed the scene or not, he may go into that situation with his gun out. So there's a difference between pulling your gun going into an unknown situation and then pulling your gun to happen to shoot somebody. So that's a big difference.
You shot a man in 1982. Where were you patrolling on that day?
I was patrolling the midnight shift, and we call it the dog watch shift, but that's the 11 o'clock to 7 in the morning shift. And I'd only been out 2 years, so I was a two-year officer. 1982, I think it was November the 1st, and I was on routine patrol, and that's a misnomer in itself, the word routine patrol, that we seems like that's when a lot of things happen to police officers. But I was checking out an abandoned house on the northwest side of town, and I noticed a suspicious person on the roof of this house. Actually, it was a rather large mansion. It was a three-story mansion, and he was on the roof, so I went to investigate, and I went up to the location where I'd last seen him on the roof, and he saw me and then ran on the fire escape down into the interior of the house, and we kind of played a cat-and-mouse game for 5 minutes or so when I was looking for him, and he was trying to elude me, and I could hear him running through the house, and he could probably hear me chasing him. And that went on for, I guess, 5 minutes or so, and then I didn't hear the noises anymore, so I went back out to my car, and that's when I heard a rustling in the bushes because there was a long hedgerow right there in front of this abandoned house. He came out of the bushes, and I guess he was about 30 feet away from me at that point. And I could tell he had something in his hands, but I really couldn't make it out at that distance and at that time of the night. The only thing I could see with my flashlight was that he was cupping his hand or holding his hand with some type of object.
What did you think might be in his hand?
Well, by the way he was holding it, I couldn't really tell at that time, but it appeared that he was holding his hand as if it was some type of edged weapon. I identified myself as a police officer. I didn't have my gun out at this point. It was still a suspicious person. And when I identified myself, he did not comply with my demands, and they were, let me see your hands. Let me see what's in your hands, and stop right there and lay down on the ground. I was treating it as an unknown suspicious person. At that point, he started walking towards me, and again, I commanded him to, you know, stay where he was at. Police officer, let me see what's in your hands. He started getting closer, and I kind of felt my space being violated, so I started to step back as he would step forward. He got to within about 15 feet, and again, I was issuing him the commands, and when I put my flashlight on him, I could tell he had silver spray paint coming from the cracks of his mouth because it kind of shined when the light hit him, and it had run down his neck. And then I saw he had a can, which I assumed had spray paint in it in one hand, but he still had this object cupped in the other hand, and I couldn't get a good look at it. But the closer he got, he was holding it as if someone would hold a knife by the handle. I started backing up some more, and he started coming towards me, at which point I guess he was less than 15 feet now, and he raised his arm up in the air as someone would holding a knife in a, you know, above the head thrust, and he yelled out, let out a scream, and then started charging me. And at this point, I pulled my gun, held it down to my side, but my first reaction was not to fire at that point. I was still trying to get away. I was doing the better part of valor, which is run. And I was retreating. I was backpedaling, but he was running faster, and he got to within 5 feet, and he started to lift back his arm like he was going to make this thrust with whatever it was he had in his hand. And that's when I raised my gun and fired, and he had got to within 5 feet when I finally pulled the trigger.
When you pulled the trigger, was that like a decision or a reflex?
It was a decision. When the shot went off, of course, anybody that's fired a gun will know that in a night like that, there's a tremendous muzzle flash. And he was close, so I figured I had hit him. By the time I got my night vision back and my vision cleared, he was still standing within that 5 feet, and he was smiling at me now.
Then what did you do?
Then I got the panic attack. I guess that's the best way to put it. From that point on, I could not fire my gun a second time because I had been conditioned, or I assumed that, you know, once I made that first shot, that the threat was going to go away and everything was going to be fine. But it really surprised me, after taking a hit in the chest with a .357, that the man was still standing. And not only that, he was smiling at me like, you got me a good one that time, but, you know, here I come again. Fortunately for me, he held that pose for just a couple of seconds, and then his knees buckled and he fell down to the ground, and at which point, you know, the situation was resolved.
Were you alone?
Yes.
No partner?
No, we don't ride partners here. By happenstance, there was a police officer like myself on patrol, but he was from Balcones Heights, which is a little town within our city limits. And he had happened to see my spotlight when I had first went up there, so he decided to go check it out. So luckily, he came upon the scene maybe just a few seconds before the shooting happened. And he was there to finally help me apprehend the guy, but he wasn't directly involved in the actual assault and the shooting.
So what turned out was in this guy's hand?
It was a stick. It was a wooden stick that had been sharpened. He had taken the end of it and sharpened it to a point.
Could he have stabbed you with it?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, when he had raised his arm back to, in a kind of like a downward motion, I assumed that he was coming at me with a knife. I knew that there was some type of, he had some type of edge weapon in his hand. And then after I saw what it was, I still realized that, you know, had he hit me in the head with it, you know, he was going to make an instant lobotomy, you know, on me.
Now, you said that there was silver spray paint around his mouth.
Correct.
Did you find out what it was doing there, how it got there?
Well, it turned out that he had a history of spray paint abuse. And he had just gotten to the point where that's...
So he was using it as an inhalant and getting high.
Correct.
Does that explain the smile on his face after he shot
him? I have no earthly idea what went through his mind or what he was thinking when he responded the way he did. Maybe he was impervious to pain. Maybe he didn't feel it. I don't know. But they determined that he was very intoxicated on that spray paint.
So you must have been stunned.
Correct.
This was like the first time you'd ever shot. This is the only time you've ever shot anybody?
Yes, first and only. Thank God.
So what went through your head right afterwards?
Fear. Fear of the unknown, especially when I found out that, you know, this didn't turn out to be a knife, although it was by its use was a deadly weapon, which authorized me to use deadly force. But the fact that it wasn't what I knew it was, and then I thought to myself, "Well, my God, now they're going to say I shot a man with a stick," and then your mind starts going through all kind of things like, "What's Internal Affairs going to think, and what's the chief going to think, and what's the public going to think, and what's the grand jury going to think," and it just goes on and on.
My guest is San Antonio police officer Roger Mangum. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. My guest is San Antonio police officer Roger Mangum, co-founder of a support group for police involved in critical incidents. Mangum shot and killed a suspect in self-defense in 1982. When did you realize that he was dead?
They told me about an hour and a half later, when I was down at the police station, being interviewed by the detectives. Because, like I said, after I had shot him, it took him a second or two before he finally fell to the ground. And by that time, that other officer that had come over to, to check on what I was doing, he went over and handcuffed the guy, and the guy was still struggling at that point on the ground, trying to get back up to come after me. So the other officer had to, pretty much keep him pinned to the ground to get the handcuffs on him. So they, of course, EMS, that's our emergency medical service, they came right out and they were working on him. They put him in the ambulance, took him to the hospital, and I was transported downtown to talk to the follow-up units. And it was during that time, it was about an hour and a half later, when they finally told me that that he had died.
What was your reaction?
I started crying.
Were you surprised?
Surprised. I don't know if surprised is the word. I was upset and devastated, even though I did it to protect myself and save my own life. It was still a distasteful job that I did.
Was your shooting covered in the papers?
Yes.
How is it covered?
I still have a headline. Police officer slays man with stick.
And that bothers you because?
Well, I think, I guess it's just a play on words, with me, but I guess that a police officer slays a man with stick, it to me, and this is just me personally, it makes me seem like there was this guy walking down the street with a stick in his hand, and I came up behind him and shot him in the back of the head. I mean, that's the impression that I got from the headline.
What about the article itself?
The article itself, surprisingly, was for the most part pretty fair, but I think it was just that attention-getting headline that kind of had an uneasy, kind of set uneasy with me.
What did you find out about the man? Did he have a family? Did he have an interesting story?
No, not really. He had been arrested. They brought up his rap sheet after that, to see the background on this person. And he had been arrested 72 times for public intoxication and fighting in public. He'd been arrested several of those times for assault on police officers.
So what were the feelings that you had after you had to shoot someone in the line of duty? Did you feel guilty, angry, afraid?
Yeah.
What was the brew of feelings?
Well, I guess you could pretty much say that it was a Monday morning quarterbacking for me and other people also. Of course, you're always going to have people that Monday morning quarterback you. But there was many times immediately after that when I myself wondered, did I do the right thing? Or what if I wouldn't have been there? Or what if I would have done this? There's so many what ifs that come up.
Mm-hmm.
Second guessing the actions or my actions. I never felt a whole lot of anger or rage, although, stress manifests itself in many ways. But mine was a little bit of depression, insomnia. Sexual appetite wasn't quite like it was for a while. I don't know if guilt really came into it because at that point, it came down to it was either him or I. So I don't know. I can't say that I was guilty about it, but I certainly wasn't, pleased with having to do that.
God, I was reading an article in American Police Beat by another officer who it was actually about another officer who had shot someone in the line of duty, mm-hmm. and was dealing with all the emotional after effects of that. And he had said one of the things he found really disturbing was that a lot of people were coming up to him congratulating him for getting another, you know, getting rid of another one of those bad guys.
Correct.
Did you get any reaction like that? You know, congratulations for getting the human garbage off the street?
Yeah. There will always be people in general and policemen specifically that will say, hey, you know, you're a hero. You did really good or good job. And I had a few of those slaps on the back and, you know, like, you know, what's it like or what, you know, how did you feel and congratulations. And I think that's just ignorance talking. I believe people that give you a pat on the back and say good job and call you a hero, usually you find that those are the people that haven't been there and they just don't know what it's like.
When you were describing what happened to you, you really knew how close the other person had come, and you said at some point that they got about 15 feet away from you, and you felt like at this point your personal space was being violated.
Right.
What are you taught as an officer where your space is being violated? How close can a person come before they're a threat to your
right.
life?
We don't really draw a line in the sand and give X amount of feet, but you know, you have to take the situation into consideration. Now, can this person, from whatever distance he's at, can he reach you and harm you before you can manage to get away or, you know, take out an intermediate weapon or pull out your gun? So it's not so much the exact amount of distance. It's what that officer perceives, you know, as the threat. How big is this person? How quick can he get to you? What are his actions? Is he running? Is he just walking or you know, stuff like that?
You're now teaching at the San Antonio Police Academy. You're teaching tactical training. Is there anything that you teach students there based on your own experiences of that night when you shot someone?
Yes. Never say it. It can't happen to me. You know, when we get young cadets and they've been pumped through all of this, you know, training, they feel like they're pretty much impervious to anything that can happen to them. And every now and then, I'll catch one of the cadets saying, well, if that situation comes up, you know, I'll do this and I'll do that because, you know, that can't happen to me. And that's one of the most fatal set of words that any police officer can make. And that is the you know, it can't happen to me because I'm academy trained. So I try to make each cadet realize that just because they're a police officer and they're putting on this vest and this gun and this badge, they are still vulnerable to, you know, any threat that can come up.
Roger Mangum is an instructor at the San Antonio Police Academy. He co-founded the police support group, POST.